Chats, the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Baremetrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Kyle Racky, founder of Proposify. We talk about Kyle's journey from a quiet, artsy kid in high school to founder of a company aiming to hit $10 million in annual revenue this year. Hear how focusing on a side project ultimately took a year and a half of no growth to doubling customers every month, and lots of other interesting bits along the way. Enjoy. Hey, Kyle. Thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be on the show, Josh. Thanks for having me.
So the way that I usually kind of kick these things off is with the backstory. So your backstory. So specifically about your upbringing. And I think in this case, it's really interesting because it's atypical, at least in my head, for most of the tech world. So I'd love to hear kind of like your childhood and kind of like what that was like for you.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny when you mention that it's atypical. I was thinking about that today. I was reading a story about a startup that's into their Series B funding, and three college students, tech students, who got together, made a company, moved to San Francisco, raised money from notable investors. Like, that's almost kind of what you normally think of, I guess, now when you think about SaaS companies and startups. But you know, there's a whole other side of companies where they started in small towns from, you know, just people from different walks of life. And I'd say we probably fit into that category. I live in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which, if people are wondering where that is, that's in far eastern Canada. Not normally known as a startup mecca or a startup, a tech hub or anything like that. We definitely have a scene that's growing, but yeah, again, not normally what people think of when they think of startups. So actually, I started off as a graphic designer back in the early 2000s. That's kind of how I got my start in print and then learned web. Eventually, I was working at an agency and decided I wanted to quit and become a freelancer when I was 24 years old. So I did that. And a guy that I met at one of the agencies was a guy 20 years older than me, Kevin, who was kind of like a bit of a father figure to me, a little bit of a mentor in terms of business and sales. Was really his background, where I was very green. I just knew about design and that was kind of it. So he kind of coached me to go to my own. But then after about 8 months of being a freelancer, I was like, you know, I kind of miss being around people and being able to collaborate. And so I invited Kevin to join with me, and we started an agency together, which we ran for about 5 years. Doing a lot of web design and kind of marketing stuff. And so that's kind of how we got our chops. We were building SaaS products for other people. But then I remembered about this idea that I had back in my freelance days of proposal software, because I was at agencies where we wrote proposals. And I just, as a sort of a side project, fun little idea, I decided to wireframe up this idea for online proposal software, which at the time wasn't really a thing. And fast forward 5 years later, or actually 10 years later, really, here we are, Proposify. It's a proposal software. We've been doing it for about 4 years full time, and have grown to just about over 4 million in annual recurring revenue. We have about 30 staffers. And so it's kind of crazy to see the transition to where we were and where we are now.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you've obviously, you mentioned 4 years, 4 million ARR, got a few dozen people on the team. So if we go back even further, like you as a kid, like, do you feel like being an entrepreneur was ever something that was on your radar? I mean, we're talking like you, like adolescent.
Yeah, I wasn't like the kid that was the born salesman or doing the lemonade stand or anything like that. I was fairly introverted, I think. You know, kind of an artsy kid into like playing music, like playing guitar and drawing. I was like the kid in class that could draw everybody, like do caricatures. I think I got in trouble a few times for drawing some teachers in, you know, in awkward situations. But yeah, no, that was kind of me. I wanted to get into like digital art when I was in high school. That's where I thought I was kind of going, was like animation or 3D modeling or something like that. Kind of fell into graphic design. I didn't know what it was until I really was in community college. But when I think back, really, like the paper route was probably my first real experience as an entrepreneur. And I'm kind of sad about the fact that newspapers and print has died, because I think paper routes are such a great experience for kids who are entrepreneurial, because it's a whole different experience from just working at a job or working at McDonald's, where you don't have somebody standing over you. You're responsible for billing customers and getting payments and making sure that customers are happy and being able to go and sell new accounts if you want to. Like, you're rewarded based on your hustle.
Yeah,
I kind of like that about paper routes. And when I really think back, that was my first experience as an entrepreneur. And then, like, kind of moving forward into my 20s, I didn't really realize until, you know, early to mid 20s that I wanted to be my own boss. I didn't come from an entrepreneurial family, and they actually discouraged it for the most part.
Well, so two things I want to touch on there. So I think the paper route thing, and you mentioned, like, you kind of hate that, like, this sort of that. I think of, like, one of the reasons that is sort of an interesting entrepreneurial venture is that it's this, like, physical product thing where, there's lots of different aspects to it, but you're also trying to basically sell a product to someone. But it's also kind of, like, low pressure in that it's just a newspaper, right? I mean, like, nobody dies if your paper doesn't get delivered or something screws up there, right?
Oh, they get pissed, though.
Like, certainly people get mad about, the most mundane things. But I, to me, like, the sort of new version of that is, like, I think of, like, to me, it's easier these days, or there's lots more tools at kids' disposal to actually produce something. So, I think, like, here, like, we have a 3D printer and, like, electronic stuff and, like, these, like, CNC machines and stuff that, like, if any of my kids think of some, like, thing that they would want to make and sell, we have the means for them to produce it and then go out and sell it, right? Like, it's a little bit more high-tech version of that. But I still think...
And even service, oh, sure, too, right? Like, back in my day, in the 90s, like, kids were still shoveling driveways here in Canada, where we get snow. I know there's a few places in the States where you do too. Shoveling driveways or mowing lawns in the summertime, like, that's saying, okay, what can I do that's of value for somebody else that saves them time that I can charge for, right? And that nowadays, it's like, it's all online. It's like, kids can probably code websites or produce YouTube videos better than a lot of adults, so you can sell that service.
Absolutely. And I think, like, to me, that's the kind of thing that is more interesting when a kid, like, wants to go down that route, is not the, like, let me go find a place I can go get a job, but, like, how do I make my own source of income?
There's a really good YouTube video. Well, it's on YouTube. It's actually, I think, a TED Talk by Cameron Harold on how to teach kids entrepreneurship. And one thing that he talks about is that instead of giving his kids chores and saying, oh, if you clean your room and do this and that, we'll pay you at the end of the week, because that's teaching your kid to be an employee. He actually says he encourages his kids to come to him and with ideas for jobs or things that they can sell him and actually negotiate on price, which is kind of a better way to teach them entrepreneurship.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I'll try that with my kids. So the second thing that you mentioned there was that entrepreneurship wasn't really encouraged, or maybe even was sort of discouraged growing up. So, I mean, why was that the case?
My parents were pretty blue collar. My dad was, like, a maintenance worker at a nursing home. He, like, fixed the, things that were broken, basically. And my mother was a nurse. And they just came up, but they just came from very, humble backgrounds. Their parents were Cape Bretoners, which, for those who don't know, Cape Breton is kind of a very rural island in Nova Scotia. It was just sort of the way they were brought up, that, like, you go, you learn a trade, you get a job, somebody pays you. Owning a business, super risky, most likely to fail. Only crazy people do that. There's just no job security. So that was sort of the environment that I just grew up in. And, like, even just taking graphic design, my parents were a little skeptical of, like, oh, you should really learn drafting or architecture or something that you can really get a job with, not this painting and drawing and, all that kind of stuff. So it was just sort of, my parents were very skeptical even when I became a freelancer going out on my own. Once they saw the results that I could actually, support my family and pay my rent and all that kind of stuff, they were a little bit more open to the idea. But yeah, initially it's just business equals scary.
So How do you, I mean, for you, how did you kind of push through the, you know, doing your own thing and kind of ignoring, because I think there's, you know, there's different personalities, like where people want to, like, having the approval of the people around them, not even necessarily the approval, but they look to people around them as sort of a validator of like, if this is the right thing to do or not, you know, what input from family is a really big deal to them.
It is a lot of probably good entrepreneurs are being held back, I think, by their families and their mothers or their fathers or siblings saying, you know, don't do this. This is a bad idea. Or they're being held back by their friends who just, you know, don't have the ambition and they're afraid of it. I think people need to listen to themselves and kind of be in tune and self-aware of what they're good at and kind of tune out those voices. But I think for me, I was seeing people around me in, because I was working in agencies as a designer. So I was seeing other designers leaving to go freelance and they were doing fine. They could get clients. That was sort of the initial gateway drug for entrepreneurship for me. And I think it can be for a lot of people when they realize that if you're good at something, if you can design or code or write or do something, again, goes back to the mowing lawns and shoveling driveways. If you can do something well that other people value and will pay for, it's actually a very low risk business. You don't have to buy a ton of products or inventory. You don't have to rent a space. You really just say, hey, do you want me to do this? Negotiate a price and do it. And if you can't be a freelancer, if you can't make it as a freelancer, you probably can't make it as an owner of a large business or a product or a service business. And you can kind of use freelance as a way to test out whether or not this is your thing. And if it doesn't work out, it's low risk. You just go back to work for somebody.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting part about entrepreneurship is that, you know, I mean, it's something you've been doing for a long time. I've been doing it for 15 years. And I mean, you know, if you include me as like a kid, like I was like that entrepreneurial kid. And to me, entrepreneurs are rarely all actually risk takers. Like, it's, in fact, it's almost in my head, entrepreneurship is really low risk because at the end of the day, like there's no chance that me or my family are going to end up on the street homeless. Because if Baremetrics doesn't work out and like just goes away, I have a skill set that I can use elsewhere, right? Like I can figure out how to make money. That's to me is like an entrepreneur is like somebody who can figure out how to make money in any mm-hmm. given situation, really. And to me, like there's exponentially more job security in that than someone, you know, who's got this job that they've had for 10, 20, 30 years. And like they're just hoping that company that they're employed at, you know, doesn't go away because then they're out of a job, right? And then they're like in a really bad spot.
Totally.
And I think like to me, the you know, thing like our parents and things like that, there's a big shift that's happening right now where our parents are, you know, my dad had basically worked at the same place for almost 30 years. And that was super typical of that generation. But now it's very rare that somebody sticks around that long, more than even like 5 years at the same place. Right. Mm-hmm. It's a healthier way to work. Like the idea of like dedicating yourself to this one specific thing for decades when there's so many other things that you could go and do. And that's a personality thing, but
it is, it's like investment, right? You don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Right.
You diversify and that way, you know, if something falls through, you've got something else somewhere else. So it's a way of managing and mitigating your risk in the investment side. And I think it's the same from a career side. If you've got a number of skills, you're really good at one thing, but you can do a few other things. You can, you know, bounce around between a startup and an agency and a, you know, whatever, like, yeah, you have so much more control as an entrepreneur. I mean, even as an employee doing that model of just sort of being able to move around to different companies. But yeah, certainly as an entrepreneur, you're in total control. Nobody can fire you unless you raise a ton of money and you've right. got a board of directors who want to fire you. That can happen. Yeah. But for the most part, you're pretty immune to being fired. The worst thing that can happen is customers don't pay you and you have to lay people off until you're the last one. I mean,
yep.
that's certainly a risk, but then you can always transition to another company. My first company, the agency, was what I consider a failure in terms of it wasn't working. We were in debt. We, sometimes struggled to make payroll, and we just got to the point where we handed it off to somebody else to run with sort of a type of acquisition, but more or less just sort of, hey, take the business and run with it. But you have options, I guess, is the point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you went to school. Did you go to school for graphic design?
I did. Yeah, I went to like the Nova Scotia Community College.
Okay, that's right. So you finish up there, and then just freelance for a while, or that's when you started the agency?
Yeah, I worked in companies for about 4 years. So I went to like a publishing company and then a couple of ad agencies, did like a digital agency. This was sort of early to mid 2000s when the web was still very young and Flash was really big. So I learned like code ActionScript on my vacation. I read like a big O'Reilly book on ActionScript. I was really just trying to be, make myself valuable to people of like, what do people want? Like, what are they hiring for? Oh, it's really hard to find Flash developers. Okay, I'm going to learn Flash.
Yep.
So that was kind of what I did initially. And then it wasn't until, I was at an agency in, I think, 2007 that I started making the move to go freelance.
So you were working at different agencies, went freelance, and then started your own agency?
Yeah, like I called my freelance business Headspace, which not to be confused with the meditation app that wasn't around back then, but we called it Headspace. And that was sort of, I invited Kevin to be my partner to start Headspace. And then we gradually started hiring people to, designers, developers, project managers, that kind of thing. And so we were, I think, at our biggest, maybe 10 to 12 people, just a small little web design shop here in Halifax.
Yeah. So what was the transition like? You mentioned the agency, you consider it a failure. So you kind of hand that off to someone else. I mean, how was that transition from agency to Proposify?
It was difficult. We had read the 37 Signals book, Basecamp, what was it called? Not Rework.
Yep.
About, how Basecamp, they're really well known for being a web design agency that built Basecamp and then kind of transition into a SaaS company. I think everybody thinks that they can be Basecamp, but what they don't realize is that it's very difficult to have a service business and just elegantly transition into a SaaS company that's growing.
Because you have to stop doing the thing that's bringing you money.
Exactly. Right. You might take one developer on your team and say, hey, on Fridays, code our SaaS product. And by then, Friday rolls around. They had their head in 10 other projects that week. They just start getting going with it. Now it's end of day. Okay, next week, code a little bit more. You just never get anything off the ground. And then what a lot of people don't realize, or what I had in mind, was that, we just launched this product and we start getting customers and then we get revenue. That's how it works. Well, we actually had about 17 months between when we launched our MVP to when we started actually getting traction. It was 17 months of just flatness, of just getting people in the product, having them not convert or having them sign up to one of our paid accounts and then cancel the next month. We had like 5 to 10 customers flatline just for about 17 months between, while we were running the agency to as we transitioned out of it and raised a little bit of money for Proposify. So it was a hard transition for sure. It was probably the most difficult 1 to 2 years that I've
had. How do you, 17 months is a long time to have this thing and either, I assume you're trying to balance that with the agency stuff. And I mean, how did you not just decide like the agency stuff brings in more money than this and this thing is not growing? So, but I mean, how do you keep that going? Like, how do you push through all that?
I think it would have been more difficult if the agency was really successful in bringing us a lot of money, but it wasn't because I was really bad at running an agency and I didn't know what I was doing. And it was a struggle. And I just frankly hated doing it. I hated working with clients. I hated the sales process of trying to get clients, keep them happy and keep our projects in scope. Like I just wasn't really that good at running it. And so and Kevin was the same, we would rather just bet it all on this SaaS product and like kind of go down with the ship than to try to keep this agency afloat for the next 5 to 10 years. I think every agency has about a 5-year testing period where you either realize you hate doing this and you want to do something else, or you're, you know, this is your thing, then you do it forever until you're retired. But for us, it was like, you know, I'd rather go work for somebody else than try to run an agency. So, you know, we basically just, it was just a bit of faith in each other and on the product. We knew we were solving a difficult problem. We knew that people wanted this software to work, and we were able to get people interested in talking about it. So I think that was sort of the clue that we're on the right track. Just the product isn't good enough. We need more time. We need more resources to get a product that actually solves the problem for people.
So when, I mean, where did the shift happen where you go from a year and a half of no growth to the project itself start growing? Like what changed?
So what changed was, you know, initially when we launched the MVP, we were running the agency. The best move we ever made was we hired a developer, and we were actually able to get some government funding for this, like a grant program where they cover a large portion of the person's salary. We were able to get a developer, Jonathan, who's now our CTO, to just come into the agency and work 100% full-time on Proposify. That, if that didn't happen, we wouldn't be here today. You know, that was an essential shift that needed to happen. And I think Basecamp even did something similar where, like, DHH, you know, just worked 100% on Basecamp. Yeah. He wasn't working on client work. So that's kind of like step one. I was working a lot on customer development and product design and just trying to make sure we were building the right thing. And that I was doing that while, you know, running the agency, and Kevin was working on keeping the agency afloat. But once we figured out we wanted to sell this thing, get rid of it, and just focus 100% on Proposify, that process was basically just trying to get rid of the agency and keep working on the startup. It was around, I think, April of 2014 that all the stars finally aligned after, you know, months of just grueling, you know, Robin Peter to PayPal. We finally closed a seed round for Proposify. It was like $270,000. Not a lot of money, but just something to kind of free us up to, like, leave the agency, three of us just work full time on the product, and then start really trying to, like, get a product out the door that solved people's problems. And so from the time we raised the money in April, it was probably May, June, it was probably another 4 months before we started to see our customer numbers double every month. And once we started getting into September, October, we went from like 10 customers to 100. We were like, okay, I think we're onto something.
It's interesting that you know, that was sort of your experience where once you were able to have full-time focus on it, that really took. So an interesting correlation here, or a similar story, I think, is like Nathan Berry at ConvertKit. So he, same sort of deal where for, I don't know, maybe 2 years, it was flat. I mean, like $1,000 a month kind of MRR, you know, and it was just sort of sitting there, and he's like focusing on writing books and producing content and stuff and trying to make ConvertKit grow, but it was very sort of on the side thing. And then as soon as he focused, he changed almost nothing with the product, but just like focused on it, figured out how to market it, and all of a sudden it exploded, right? But I think a lot of times, especially entrepreneurs who are capable of, like, have a lot of skills, maybe not, they're not like amazing at any single given skill, but like they're just able to do lots of things. It's easy to do lots of things and to, you know, diversify, but at the same time, there's something to be said of going 100% on something to, you know, see its full potential, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, I still talk, even though we think that everybody knows this, everybody knows you should focus on one thing and do it really well if you want to have any major success. I still talk to entrepreneurs every day who don't get it, or they just buck against this advice, and they're like, no, you know, you always hear you got to focus. No, I want to be a musician, and I want to, you know, have my album blow up, and I want to do, like, you know, my freelance agency service thing, but I want to do my side hustle where I've got this like cool social networking startup that I'm like, and I don't know how to get this through people's heads to be like, all three are going to be at 10, 20, 30% maybe. Forever until you decide to go on one thing. I don't know. There's still a lot of resistance to this idea of focus.
I think part of it is that when you focus hard on something, it's like it's putting everything in one basket, and then and it sort of acknowledges that, or it increases the possibility that you could sort of dramatically fail at it, right? Whereas if you spread yourself out, you can be like, well, this little thing didn't work, but this other thing is still working, and like you kind of like keep limping along. But if you put it all in one basket, it sets you up to actually, you know, like go down in flames.
It's
know?
A bit of shiny ball syndrome too, right?
Yeah.
It's there are people, and I think entrepreneurs are maybe a bit more inclined this way to just be very easily distracted and easily bored. And so if, you know, when you get into the guts of trying to get a startup to take off, especially when you have put everything into it and it's not working, you have to resist that tendency that we all have to just give it up and just say, okay, this isn't working, or it's too hard, or it's too boring, it's tedious, like whatever that voice in you that's telling you to, it's like that voice when you start running the first 10 minutes or doing any sort of physical activity, your voice is like, no, just sit down, have a coffee. You know what I mean? Stop doing this painful thing. It's not fun. And you just have to push through it.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So you guys, you finally start getting some growth, and seeing it really sort of take off. I presume relatively quickly the Proposify starts doing better than the agency itself was doing. What was that like for you to sort of realize, hey, I'm on to something that's actually working?
Yeah, I mean, we had been out of the agency for close to a year by the time Proposify started really taking off. And that was, you know, it felt great. It felt like we were sort of validated. Okay, maybe we're not idiots. Like, maybe we can actually pull off a business and not struggle. You know, still very early stage. You know, I think in 2015, we had grown to, I can't remember, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think we were getting close to 100,000 MRR by the end of 2015, but you know, it was still, we hadn't raised any money yet. We were still just bootstrapping and funding, you know, hiring new people based off of profit and revenue. And we resisted the urge to raise money, but yeah, it was pretty crazy. Like how growth works. A lot of people think it's linear and it just sort of, you just start growing month over month. But in actual fact, growth gets easier the farther you are into it. Until it doesn't, there's sort of that S curve you've probably seen where it's like it took us 4 years to get to 1 million ARR. It took us 3 years or something like that. But then the next year we got to 3. So in 1 year we tripled.
Right.
Right. It's just kind of weird the way that works.
Yeah. But, I mean, so when you crossed, you're saying that the agency was at, maybe around 10, 12 people. What was it like going for, you know, managing a team that's, you know, was twice that size? I mean, like what sort of struggles or issues was it to balance a team that's like double the size of anything you had managed before?
Oh, I mean, there's a world of difference between managing a team of 10 people and managing a team of even 30, right? Or 40 or 50, which is where we're going in terms of how big we're scaling by the end of the year. Learning a lot of new skills. There's a startup that's in sort of find product market fit, that sort of early stage, just hustle, get customers, is a totally different company than one that's growing at a certain percentage point every month and has a board of directors and has a management team in place. And the skills that got you that initial traction aren't what's going to help you scale up into a big company. So this has been probably the most fun and most challenging part for me in the last year, is sort of getting into that actual scale up CEO stage and learning those skills about how to manage properly. But I think one of the biggest things that's helped us is hiring a business coach, who's basically challenged us and helped us point us in the right direction of how to gain those skills. And implementing, there's a book called Traction by Gino Wickman. That's been really helpful in terms of how to set goals, how to lead your management team, doing weekly syncs, you know, big rock planning. Like there's just so much around management that you could learn from that book.
Do you consider yourself more, or maybe enjoy more the management side of things, or do you really enjoy the product side more?
I still am involved quite a bit on product, but not in terms of really the implementation, but working with our head of product to kind of plan out features, because my background as a designer and a product person was, you know, you don't want to lose that, or you don't want to just be completely out of the loop on it. So I'm still quite involved in terms of figuring out, like, talking to customers or reading customer tickets and looking at the long-term vision of what Proposify should be. So I still like kind of having a little bit of a hand in that, and maybe working with designers on some wireframing some ideas and working through the process a bit. But there's sort of that thing that keeps me creatively interested. And then there's, you know, the more CEO type management stuff around planning board meetings and planning quarterly goals and all that stuff. I'm actually having fun with both of them now. Whereas a year ago I was stuck. I actually felt like I had hit a plateau and I didn't know how to get to the next stage. I didn't even know what the next stage looked like.
Right. What do you attribute the success of Proposify to?
I think we understood the problem we were solving very, very deeply because we had experienced it. I had experienced it all throughout my career. So did Kevin. And we knew exactly who we were talking to. We were talking to companies just like us, small web design agencies, digital marketing agencies, who all had the same problem. And I think especially early on where we focused, we said we're helping, you know, small agencies close more deals and write proposals and spend less time on proposals. Like, just nailing that value proposition and nailing that pain point has helped us get to where we're at now. I think if we tried to go too broad with it and try to just become like DocuSign, that we wouldn't be.
So, I mean, it was sort of the same, like taking that same focus that it took early on to even make the thing grow, like keeping, again, going back to focusing on what you're really good at and putting all your eggs sort of in one basket.
At least early on, like we are broadening out now as we're sort of getting into scale mode. We're still, you know, we don't want to be all things to all people, but to that first couple of years, if people can really focus on one core customer base and understand them intimately. One of my favorite quotes is by Nicholas Kuzmich, a marketing guy, who says that great marketing isn't when you understand your audience. It's when your audience feels understood by you. And so when you're, you know, the headlines you're writing, the ads you're writing, signal to that buyer, oh man, it feels like they made this just for me. They understand me so well. If you can get to that point, it becomes so easy to sell what you're making.
Yep. What's the next year look like for you guys? I mean, it's hard to even think probably a few months out a lot of times, but you know, 6 to 12 months, what's on the horizon for you guys?
So we have just closed about 2 months ago on our first major round of investment. Mm-hmm. And we had resisted it for a long time, but we sort of found the right investor and the right deal that made sense for us. And so now we have some capital in the company to really experiment with. So it's an exciting time where we're, like I said, scaling up the team, trying to hit a really aggressive number of 10 million ARR by the end of the year. That's kind of where our head's at right now. I think sometimes people look too far in the future where it's hard to predict where things will go, but you know, at least for this year. And I think for most SaaS companies, if you're not at 10 million ARR yet, then you don't need to expand, you know, to another international market or create a new product. Like, you really just need to double down and focus on what got you here to get that first 10 million. And then you're sort of a little bit more, you know, freed up, I guess. You're a little less vulnerable and you can now kind of experiment with other ideas.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, how can people get in touch?
So people can email me, kyle@proposify.com. People can check out the site and our blog and podcast. We talk a lot about sales and agency stuff, but we also talk a little bit about product and entrepreneurship as well. So people can check us out there. And yeah, we're all over the social media channels. So people can just look up Proposify or Kyle Racky.
All right, right on. Hey, thanks for hopping on the call, Kyle.
Thanks for having me, Josh. Had a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right, there we have it, Kyle Racky of Proposify. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I would love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com or on Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to other conversations with startup founders, dozens of them. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes goes a long way. Thanks again and see you next week.